listened has noted this. He suggested that people are really kind to him because of his disease. And in a blog that he wrote, he reflected on how kind people are because of his Parkinson's disease, yet at the time that he was writing the blog, how cruel Australians were towards a guy called Adam Goods. And he was saying, why is it, how could it be that the same Australians who in a train could get up and want to help him, yet on the way in the football game could yell out such horrible abuse to the Adam Goods back when that was a significant incident? I've noticed this with Australians is we actually are extraordinarily kind to many different types of people and their challenges in life. But what fascinates me is how Aboriginal people don't always receive that same level of kindness. I find that quite fascinating that over the last, say, 2 years, we've had serious advocacy for certain minority groups in our nation, and yet very little noise around the plight of our Aboriginal First Nations people. I just find that fascinating because I personally am of the conviction that our first moral problem in Australia is to do with our First Nations people. That if we should attend to anything in referendums and in the political sphere, why aren't we doing that? That's what I think. Granted, I'm biased. I'm Maori, so of course I've got some affinity with loss of land and place in society. I grew up with Aboriginal people, so of course I know people by name. I'm biased, but I would consider that our first moral challenge is this. I've even noticed it in church. In church we have many challenges before us. There's, we mentioned today, the homeless. We have challenges of place, the place of women in our church leadership, things like this. When I first, at a denominational level, started talking about, well, how are we responding to our First Nations people, this is grouped up as part of all the different kinds of challenges we face as a Baptist movement. I actually think this is different. This is like a first degree problem. We've got to attend to this. Because what I've noticed, certainly among our churches, is we may have said this is clustered up with all the other kinds of challenges that we have, but I've noticed that it had little voice. Little voice. In 1999, our denomination made a sorry statement. Well attended. There was about 600 people went to Flinders Street Baptist and joined in our movement of churches. And then what I noticed, being a non-Baptist grown-up person, is I noticed that essentially nothing happened between 1999 and the next 8 years. Just kind of got lost. So why is it that we can focus on some issues better than others? And a genuine question, why is it that the state of Aboriginal people seems to be lower on our moral order and our moral priority in Australia? It's a genuine question. I'll be at the front. If you can help me answer that question, I'd be very thankful for that. Research shows us that we evaluate the wrongs of others much more harshly than we do with our own. Jesus, I think, names that. And he talks about how we look at, we're very good at seeing specks in other people's eyes, yet fail to attend the what he calls the log in our own eye. We judge others differently than ourselves because we consider that what we would have done if we were in their situation. What would I be like if I were in their shoes? That may seem like a fair way to judge, but in practice we think more highly of our own ability to handle their problems. This is what psychologists call a superiority bias. We think we are generally better than average. And so it's quite difficult for us to appreciate what it is like to be in other people's shoes with what they have. It's far better for us to try and see people's challenges from their perspective, show empathy rather than only judgment. And this is what Micah 6:8 addresses when it there's this call to do justice. It says, do justice, and it's quickly followed by act justly and love mercy. The word for mercy, the Hebrew word for mercy is chesed. And what the prophet is saying is your actions of justice need to be matched by an attitude of kindness, mercy. The Jews would tell you that chesed is God's kind of love. It's the word used for the way that God behaves. And Micah's already shared what that looks like in verses 4 to 5 of chapter 6 of Micah. That God loved Israel with a persistent, faithful love in spite of Israel's fickleness. I brought you up out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. I sent Moses to lead you and Aaron and Miriam. He talks about how he freed them from kings and followed them in their journey. And this is all in spite, despite their own behavior. God exercised his hand of justice from a heart of love. If you pursue justice alone, that can be quite cruel, particularly with this bias to judge others more harshly. But when our hearts are full of mercy, kindness and empathy, then doing justice will be truly just, is what the prophet calls us to. When it comes to living as Australians together, which is what our series is about. So our series at the moment is looking at the way that we live with our Aboriginal brothers and sisters. It's far better to see things from their perspective than issuing judgment. And that's why we ought to listen and understand. I want you to watch this video just to hear one person's story to help us listen.
Went into the dormitory as a tiny babe. I was 6.5 months old. My mother was 19. I said to Mum, tell me how you felt when they took us away. She said, well, I wasn't supposed to be taken away, she said. I went there to settle your granny and your grandfather into Cherbourg because it was 1929. The depression was on and it was hard for him, and the policeman said, if you go to Bramber, that's what it was called then, they'll look after you with food and stuff, he said, then you can come back again. She thought, well, a little while wouldn't be hurt us. I'll take Ruth with me and we'll go there. She wasn't allowed out. She said, I remember standing there when the superintendent came out to greet us, and he said, well, we've got no homes here for yous, but Ruby and Ruth can go to the women's dormitory. We weren't supposed to be there. Ruby and Ruth wanted to get out straight away. The dormitory was always filled with single parents, single women. They pulled them out of the camp if they had a child, any children of people in the camp. They brought them to the dormitories. Once you were taken from your parent, you had no more connection with them. No more. Absolutely nothing. We were removed from our families. But we sat in the same dining hall, big dining hall, children one side and the grown-ups the other side. And I said to Mum, you never sat with your face towards me at the dining room. She said, I couldn't. I could not look at you. Now, you got your mother, you know, and he's a 4.5 kid taken from her. 4.5 kid is looking for attention. She never looked around. She said, because we weren't allowed to utter a sound at the table. table. Never a sound. Not even to put a spoon down. We had to slide those seats back so quietly. I was always stood in the middle of the dining hall until everybody finished eating. I had to stand there. I couldn't lift, you know, stand on one leg. Or I just had to stand there. And my mother said, Ruthie, I just knew you got into so much trouble. Well, I guessed it was because I was trying to get her attention. And yet I was punished for that. And when I was five, then they sent her away. As they did to most of the mothers, they sent them out to work. So they didn't give anybody a chance to lead another life. I mean, there were people who knew that it was wrong. But they just kept us there. So I was there till I was 14. They had their own idea about protection. I mean, that wasn't our idea. I don't think we needed protection. They were doing the best that they could for us. I don't know what the best was. I can never understand that. They were doing this for us, turning us into people, I guess. People would say it was for your own good, but my own good was to stay with my mum.
But they don't know the pain in me, 'cause they can't know what I can see. I'm surrounded by misery. I'd like to be always free, far away home.
Thanks, Christian. Ruth Hegarty's story is being separated from her mother is very tragic and sadly has been often repeated across our country. Between 1910 and 1970, because of government policies, many Indigenous children were forcibly removed from their families. And those children became known as what we now call the Stolen Generations. That policy of child removal left a legacy of trauma and loss. It affects Indigenous communities, families, and even individuals today. They were taught, these children, to reject their heritage. They were made to adopt white culture. They were no longer permitted to speak their language. The names were changed, and some were adopted by white families, and many were placed in institutions. A home that's quite near us is called Colebrook Homes. Have you been to Colebrook? It's up in Eden Hills, and there's a reserve there now. Colebrook Homes mostly house children from the northern South Australian cattle stations where their parents sometimes lived. Some children were placed there by their parents so they could receive schooling. Others were forcibly removed from their families under those policies. It's believed around 350 children lived at Colebrook. Some were are now known to us as well-known South Australian identities. So Dr. Lowitcher O'Donoghue, I believe Lowitcher came to church here for a period of time while I think she was training. Colebrook Homes was closed in 1981 and the building was demolished and no longer exists. In 1997, they put a reconciliation park there. The former there was a Blackwood Reconciliation Group made that happen. And then there's this powerful statue, if you could just show us that picture of a grieving mother. If you haven't been there, it's well worth going, just sitting in front of that statue. Some of the residents think of their time at Colebrook as really good. Uncle Clyde Rigney, who's a Ngunnawal elder, who I know very well, speaks of his time at Colebrook as a time of good education. a good sense of safety and family and home. Others remember more the broken links to their culture, the loss of their family. So Auntie Mona Olsen, who again I know very well and is just a dear, godly Christian lady, she was taken from the APY lands, and she did not see her mother until 32 years after she was removed. She was told that her family did not want to keep her, but when she returned back to her family lands, she found out that her family had cried, well, to quote her, every morning as the sun came up for 37 years because of these children that had been taken from them. In 1998, when this grieving mother statue was unveiled, Auntie Mona said these words, "Today is a day to honour our mothers. We'll never fully understand their grief, the empty space in their hearts, their arms, their unfilled expectations, watching that child grow. We've wept many tears, but we should let our mourning turn to joy, knowing not one of us was a mistake. Our lives were ordained by God of love and justice. The suffering we have endured has made us a strong people, a courageous people, a people of compassion." One of the most profound times in my life was I was 16 years of age, and Auntie Mona and my dad were good friends. And so she took us through the APY lands to visit all of her family, to show the country that she didn't get to grow up on, but to show her people. It was profoundly moving to kind of be in her land and see her at home. And she would say, "I don't know my language. I haven't been in this land." And there's a deep sense of grief for her. Now, I think Aboriginal people have to come a long way to say the kinds of things that Auntie Mona says here, that we should let our mourning turn to joy. Those aren't easy words to say. Most of us in our own bitterness and sorrow struggle to find joy. Well, why not these folk too? Auntie Mona has Christian faith. She has a deep narrative of reconciliation, of healing, of forgiveness deep in her spirit. And if you spoke to Auntie Mona, she'd say that was no small reason why she could say that the suffering we've endured has made us a strong people. Not every Aboriginal person has access to that same kind of spirit, that same kind of story. And so they struggle because of all this loss that was inflicted on them, through society, through governments, and sadly also through churches. Many of them have had their languages and culture taken from them as the missionaries and governments taught them that you needed to now live the way of the white people. It wasn't until 1949 that Indigenous people received the right to vote. And then in 1962 they were considered citizens. This is not a long time ago. It's not until the 1967 referendum that Australia's first people were no longer counted as property, but counted as people on the census. It's sobering to think of these things within the lifetime of my parents. It's been massive change. The more you look, the more you find sustained systemic abuse of Aboriginal people. And that's why we can never imagine what we would do if we were in their situation. You and I have no idea what it is like to be in their shoes. You can't. This runs deep. It's done so for generations. Can we know what it's like to grow up with parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents who've experienced such trauma? who've been wrenched from their family, their language, their land, their culture. And what is it like when you know that this is true for the majority of Aboriginal people in Australia? This is not just your unique story, a sad exception. This is the normal. You cannot understand. You can't imagine what it looks like to start from their position. I was sharing with Heather that the youth group I grew up in, about half of the boys had committed suicide by the time I'd gone to university. You cannot fathom what it means for a community to have that level of sadness. Can you? I was shocked to find out that 90% of all Australian suicides by March had been Indigenous. That's just, it's unbelievable. So we say a lot of things about people not grasping the opportunities they have before them. And we'd say, honestly, our government has tried to throw money and opportunity. And I often hear people aren't making the most of what they've been given. But we can't see it from their perspective, can we? It's hard to know. When you've got generations of unemployment. Just a little insight on my life. I have like 40, maybe 50, I'm not quite sure, first cousins. My father's one of 12 children. He had six, and most of his siblings had six or so or more. There's a lot of us. And one of the things that in New Zealand I found out is all Maoris can get free university education the whole way through. Wish I'd known. After paying for 3 degrees. Anyway, I found this out. So here's the thing. Among all my first cousins, 40 or let's call it 40. Among all my first cousins who all could have got free education, how many do you think took a hold of the free education? 7 of us. 7 of us did. 3 of them are my siblings who paid for our education, right? And I was like, why wouldn't you do this? It's free. And it's because my grandfather was a mechanic, truck driver. He raised mechanics and truck drivers. He raised mechanics and truck drivers. Even when I said to my parents, I'm the first person that they, on both sides, had ever known that wanted to go to university. I said to my parents, I'm going to go to university and do engineering. And they said to me, why would you want to do that? That's useless. You'll be a good for nothing. Do something useful. Become a truck driver and a mechanic. And there's nothing wrong with that. Just by that stage, I'd already done like 15 years of an apprenticeship on my dad's workshop floor and knew I definitely didn't want to be a truck driver or a mechanic. But you see what happens when you've got generations of people who think the way they think. And then everyone you know thinks that way. So my cousins, their friends are my cousins. They don't have friends. It's called whānau, family. They don't really have many friends outside of the whānau. So everyone thinks the way they think. And what does it take to shift that? It's a good question. It isn't just money. It isn't just opportunity. It takes a lot. It takes a lot. And so whatever judgments you might bring to Aboriginal people and the choices that they're making, I would urge you to start where God starts with us. That God sees things from our point of view in Jesus. This is the power of the incarnation. He walks in our shoes. He does understand our weakness. We experience in Jesus such forgiveness, such loving kindness, even at tremendous cost to himself, while we were sinners. While we didn't deserve anything, God showed chesed towards us, his loving kindness. The people in Micah's time didn't see that connection between the grace they received and the grace they were supposed to give. They assumed all they were supposed to do was bask in their blessings, bring their offerings, and live happily ever after. They underestimated what God required of them. These people missed that they were living under the reign of God, who loved the poor as well as the rich, the widow as well as the wealthy, and that their proper response to the grace God poured out on them was to do justice and to show mercy, especially for the sake of the most vulnerable. That call is on us, and should we not do the same for our nation's first Australians? Let me pray. Firstly, our God, thank you that you love all tribes, all tongues, all nations. And that the vision of heaven is not one where we're flattened out into one culture, one tongue. The vision of heaven is each nation and tribe and tongue will come with their distinctive contributions and be them fully themselves before the throne of God. All of this variety of skin colour, of culture, of language is part of your purpose. All of this diversity is part of your wisdom. God, in our time, we live in a nation which has, some estimate, a couple of hundred diverse First Australian peoples, tribes and tongues. And God, they, we know, are trying to find their way to be fully themselves, to take the culture and the place and the language that you purposed, and to find in their identity that you indeed have blessed. So when we hear stories like Ruth or Aunty Mona's, where they feel like they walk now as strangers in their own land, we grieve because we don't believe, I hope, that this was of your purpose and your making. So I want to confess, our God, that there is sin here, and sin has had an impact, and we now today live with that impact as a nation, and people generationally live with that impact. And we would ask, just as only Mona said in those words, that you might be able to, in your grace, turn mourning into joy, turn the suffering and sorrow into character and courage, and help us as people who know the justice and mercy of God to be just and to show mercy to our Aboriginal people and also to those around us. This we pray through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.